This is a public meeting and we welcome everyone who's here. What I'm going to do is ask that we start up the recording and also on the Adobe Connect. And again, for those who are joining either on the phone or in the room, we do have this available on the ICANN schedule with a link to the Adobe Connect. And we also have audio from that link. And so let's go ahead and start the recording. Okay, the recording is started. And this is Julie Hedlund. And I would like to go ahead and turn the session over to the chairman of the ESSAC, Steve Crocker.
Thank you. If you don't mind, is there a portable mic I can...
Yes.
Thank you, Julie. So it's a distinct pleasure to be here. And for anybody who doesn't know my name, I'm Steve Crocker, and I've been chair of this this quite excellent committee from its inception several years ago. This is our time when we take the opportunity to present the work that we've been doing that's accumulated since the last meeting, and so this is a regular part of our schedule. And it's a somewhat odd aspect of ESSAC, as distinct from perhaps all of the other components of ICANN, that we don't have a natural time when all of the ESSAC members would ordinarily gather together. We've taken in the past couple of years to having a separate retreat in which we get everybody together, but typically we get a fraction of our committee at ESSAC at ICANN meetings. We get a somewhat different fraction of our committee shows up naturally at IETF meetings, and we take the opportunities that those provide to get to have committee meetings that are a hybrid between our the people who are here and people on the phone. We just completed a committee meeting next door. And then, as I said, this is our opportunity to make a presentation to the community at large. I want to especially recognize that the newly formed SSRT, and this is the what I'm looking for is Hartman, Security Stability Resiliency Review Team. There's two R's in there. Okay, SSRT, somewhere in there. Taking a break from its session today, internal organizational session, to come and attend, and so I'm very appreciative. And of course, we'll be ready, willing, and able to engage with you on any terms that you want and be helpful. And look forward to the output. So, I think I won't take the delay of going around and introducing all of the ESSAC members here, but everybody's listed. We have made a very concerted effort to put all of our materials on the website to provide details of our processes. Internally, we've built operational capture our operational processes that have developed over time. We've transformed our reports to include a little bit more accountability about who participated in, whether or not there's any contrary opinions, and documented all of that. And we are just in the process of completing the last details of the mandated bylaw mandated review process. And as it's worked out, although we were sort of in the middle of the pack in terms of the those processes that were started up, I think we may actually wind up being first to complete the last little details with a piece of business to be passed at the board meeting Friday, and we'll all breathe a sigh of relief that that's behind, and just in time, I think, to start it up again. I think these are on three-year cycles or something. So with that, here's the agenda. A brief update on root scaling, which I'll cover in a second. A talk on Registrant's Guide to Protecting Domain Name Registration Accounts. Over our existence, without planning ahead, without trying to organize the space of topics that we were thinking about, protecting registrations has turned out to be one of the most important recurring themes in different aspects. And so I'm very pleased to see this particular piece of work. And it all is, as I say, part of what has emerged as maybe one of our primary activities over a period of time. A totally different element is looking at invalid TLD queries at the root, and Dave Piscatella will give that report remotely. Is that it? Is that her? Yeah. So with that, oh, that isn't it. So that's right. Not so much by way of apology that I look like I don't know what I'm doing here, but I have been trained up to not know what I'm doing because Julie knows what she's doing and has gotten this so well under control that I have fallen into the habit of being completely dependent. So the ESAC review of Registry Transition Program, Jim Galvin will talk briefly on that. Internationalized Registration Data Working Group is a very substantial effort that has been underway that we have been co-partners in, and Steve Shang will talk about that. And, you know, this last topic I think I actually covered, implementation of ESAC improvements. If there's time left, I can say a bit more. But if we run out of time, then I've had my primary words on it, which is we've done all the administrative stuff. All the pieces are available online. So with that, let me move on. Here's our current activities. The blue-colored items are the ones we're going to talk about today, and then there's other topics that are in progress. Discussion and consideration of the high security TLDs program, member recruitment, registrar failures, and so forth are other topics that we're working on in the background but not reporting on today. Okay, so moving right into root scaling update. Quite some time ago, spring, maybe even before spring of last year, February, the board formally asked RSAC, SAC, and staff to look at the compound effects of scaling up the root with perhaps large numbers of new TLDs, the introduction of IDNs, the introduction of DNSSEC, the addition of IPv6 addresses to the root, and to look in broadly at both the quantitative and the qualitative aspects of this. We formed a steering group among those three groups, four from ESAC, four from RSAC, and four from the staff, as I recall, and engaged and funded an external team to go look vigorously at this. The board had asked at the time for a report by June, I think. We pushed back and said far too quickly, we'll get it done by September. We flogged this group hard to get done by September, which they did. But in the process, the results were governed, I would say, more by time, and there were areas which, although they worked very diligently and quite conscientiously, I know they took it all quite seriously. In the end, what they reported back, we found ourselves not able to to simply take and move forward and say, yes, this is the complete picture, and this is and the recommendations that are embodied that are ones that we want to put forth. And back up one slide. So the result was that they produced a report. There was a related report that they had commissioned with a Dutch organization, TNO, and As I said, they had a number of recommendations. We backed away somewhat from that. The three groups then considered what to do and chose to go separate paths, basically. And we now have all completed our work. The staff submitted a report a few weeks ago. RSAC submitted a report quite recently, a week or two ago. I've lost track exactly. I'm looking around for Suzanne. There she is. Somewhere in the last couple of weeks, if I recall, something like that.
Yeah, the date it was submitted to the board was actually November 25th.
I see. Okay, good. And I'm pleased to note that we have finally completed our report, and it is submitted. Yes, Rom? Yeah, it's submitted yesterday. We make a standard practice of giving the board 48 hours as a kind of courtesy before we post it publicly, just as a matter of form. So I think it will go up tomorrow. That's right. And it's a very short report, and I'm going to cover the essence of it here and now. So quite obviously, the route is now signed. That was one of the big question marks as to what the impact was going to be. In short, it all went super smoothly. There's lots of kudos to hand out to the VeriSign, NTIA, and ICANN teams that were involved in this. And I have to say, from being a close observer but not a direct participant, that it was handled with an extraordinary amount of skill and conscientiousness and finesse. So it was really very well done. IPv6 addresses were, in fact, being added well before this process and have continued to be added at a steady rate. IDNs were introduced, tested thoroughly, and are now added formally. There were test versions that were added that were functionally equivalent to the ones that are now functioning for a variety of countries, Egypt and Russia and Saudi Arabia and China and Taiwan and so forth. Those have all gone very smoothly. So much of the sort of qualitative risks of whether or not any of these particular kinds of additions would cause a problem are essentially behind us, and everybody's been watching, all the operators have been watching very closely. No significant outages, no particular glitches. Next slide. The other big aspect of this was a question of how large the root zone might grow. For many years, the root was well below 300 entries, so one for every country or territory, and then another 20, roughly, so-called GTLDs. The question is, would anything break as it scaled up? And absent any particular concrete information, different people understood that it might grow by another 100. Other people thought 1,000. Some people were worried that it might grow to be 1,000,000. Other people were concerned that it might have no bounds whatsoever and that there might be political forces that would drive it in an accelerating way out of control. So there was a wide spectrum of concern. One of the most important elements in this whole dialogue is that there is now a much crisper understanding of what the maximum rate over the next few years can possibly be based upon what the front end of that process is, that is, the applications that come in and the processing of those applications within ICANN. So before the root server system is ever engaged, there's a kind of a very tight metering or rate limiting. Just as a artifact of the rate at which applications are going to be reviewed and the thoroughness with which they're going to be reviewed. One can quibble slightly about the numbers, but 1,000 per year as an upper bound has emerged as the term. The more realistic thinking is it'll be like a few hundred, and even that depends upon market pressure. It could be well below that. I could make a case that the preferred number should have been chosen at 1,500, but we're in an area where it doesn't matter, and I'm perfectly happy that 1,000 is the term that's being used. That number has been socialized very directly and explicitly with the root server operators, who have come back and said, yes, we can handle this over the next few years. Keep us informed. Let's keep talking, in summary. Next slide. So this now resolves to a couple of very straightforward questions without a lot of fanfare. Can the root system sustain a maximum growth of 1,000 new GTLDs per year for the first round of new GTLD applications? And if ICANN subsequently increases its capacity to approve more applications, what should the process be to handle this increase? And next slide. And the answers embodied in a handful of recommendations that we're making is formalize and publicly document the interaction between ICANN and the root server operators with respect to these. That ICANN, that NTIA, and VeriSign should publish statements or a joint statement if that they are materially prepared for the proposed changes. The third recommendation is that ICANN should publish estimates of expected and maximum growth rates of TLDs, including IDNs and their variants, and solicit public feedback on these estimates. So this is the process in which numbers like that 1,000 will be revised, and provide a process for others, the public comment process and so forth, for others to ask the hard questions: where did those numbers come from? Do we believe those numbers? What are they? How stable are they? Will they withstand changes in assumptions and so forth? And then the fourth recommendation is that ICANN's SSR plan should include actual measure and monitoring and data sharing capability of the root zone performance, and implicit in that is some definition of what those measurements will be, and that involves consultation with the operators and other performers. And then the last recommendation goes off in a somewhat different direction. We knew from the beginning, as we dived into this area, that although the explicit direction and focus was the impact on the root server system, this is the 13-lettered root server operations and all of their Anycast instances and the distribution process for provisioning those and so forth, that there's a larger world out there. One aspect of it is that it was suggested that within many enterprises, the fact that the number of TLDs had been stable for a long time was baked in a little more deeply than one might wish from an architectural point of view into the operations of these enterprises, and that the appearance of new TLDs might run across boundaries that, although not mandated by standards or anything, were nonetheless built into their operations. Another form of that same thing is that there may have been local identifiers that are showing up inside of enterprises, then there could be the possibility of collisions and so forth. So you might have, .abc machine screw company having their own internal TLD, for example. I'm just making that up on the fly. No work has gone into that of any substance, but that idea of being concerned about it has been around for a while, and so one of our recommendations is to open up a separate line of inquiry on that. So that completes the set of recommendations, and as I said, these recommendations have been forwarded to the board. The formal report will be posted tomorrow, and that will bring this effort to a close after an extended period of time. I'm sure that there will be follow-up over the further years, but we'll view it as a fresh effort. And so with that, let me ask if there are questions, discussions, comments, anybody want to ask about that? Go ahead. We need a microphone.
Yeah. I'm Mike Rodenbaugh on the GNSO Council. Just a quick question. Is there any difference between the impact of an IDN TLD and an ASCII TLD on the root zone?
So that's a good question. Any difference in impact between an ASCII and an IDN TLD? That was essentially one of the questions that was embodied in the original question, whether IDN TLDs would have any impact. And all of the data suggests that there's no difference at all. Just to look under the covers for a moment, we know that the internal representation of an IDN TLD is a ASCII string that starts XN dash dash and so forth, and so it's in the lingo of my mathematical background is reduced to a previously solved problem. So at that level, it's all extremely ordinary, and in fact, the pieces are pretty much now. There's the external parts of that. How do the user systems deal with IDNs? But that's sort of out of the scope of the direct question of impact on the root service. And the answer is a pretty firm and clean no impact, no difference at all. I know you intended for a short question and even a shorter answer, but I wanted to emphasize that. Any other questions? We're good.
Hold on. Any questions from those who are on the phone?
So we're running two external groups here, interactions. One through the chat room and another through the phone line. Okay, good. Well, Alejandro.
Good morning, Alejandro Pisanti. Steve, in your view or other members of the ESAC, what would be good sources of information to know the threat landscape around the DNS that are more or less kept up to date?
We just had an extended and vigorous discussion of the broader question of threat landscape of DNS. Let me, with respect, ask that we hold that question aside. It's a question that deserves a serious and considered response, but in the context of this report at this moment, let me just say it's sort of out of scope and table it in the sense of putting it away for a moment. But we have to come back and revisit that so I appreciate that. Thanks. So thank you very much. I think it's time to move on to the next topic. Rick. You're welcome to present from there or here, as you prefer.
Yes, my problem is to torment people from being on foot. Okay, so I'm Rick Wilhelm from Network Solutions, and I was part of a working group that I think Warren chaired for us. Other folks that are here, Jim Galvin participated, Jeremy Hitchcock, who's not here, Zhaidong Li, who's I think here, and several of us had spent some time working on a follow-on to SAC 040. SAC 040 was really about protecting registrars and the things that they can do to protect their customers. And I should also add that he's not here in the room, but Dave Piscatello from ICANN's staff did a tremendous amount of work supporting us and herding the various cats and such. And so this was about how can we put together some advice from the ESAC and provide it to registrants themselves about the ways that they can protect their accounts. What we'll do here in this thing is the paper is about 30 pages, but it actually reads a lot faster than that, but I might have a twisted sense of what that means, so your mileage may vary. And we'll spend a few minutes here kind of giving a little bit of an overview of what's going on there and then really try and have a little bit more, take some questions and such about that. So you can go to the next one. So the one of the big things that we determined as we started to do some research on this is that the kind of threats that are out there are extremely they're changing a lot. So although they kind of root into a lot of basics around making sure that people gaining unauthorized access to a registrant's account, they sort of orient around that. But then once someone has access to the account, which may or may not be authorized, which is an interesting thing, some of these other things come into play. For example, someone can get a hold of your account, make DNS changes, and vector all of your mail to go somewhere, or vector all of your mail to be sort of tromboned, if you will, through a waypoint as a man-in-the-middle attack, and then sent back and such back into your mail system and such. They can change your contact info. They can redirect your website. You can actually go and move your DNS to a different DNS hosting provider. And so what's interesting about a lot of these things is that if you're lucky, things will break loudly and violently, and you'll know it. The worst thing in some ways that can happen is that any of these threats happen and you don't realize it, right? Sort of like you're driving along and there's something wrong in your car, but the engine light didn't come off, and the next thing you know, your car is shedding pieces at a high rate of speed on the highway. And some of that can get into interfering with your ability to renew the name, renewing it in ways you didn't expect, or failing to let the renewal happen, intercepting the renewal request, such that then the domain expires and someone can gain control of it. So as a registrant, there's a lot of threats that we talk about. Some people might find this very much, of course and obvious, but some of these kind of get a little bit more subtle and are kind of a little bit more interesting. So what can you do? We talk about this in the paper. Probably the first and foremost thing is protecting your account credentials with the same level of care that you do sort of a bank account sort of a thing, because this really is your registrant account contains a bunch of assets that are in your possession. I think it's something's ticking. Hopefully it's not going to explode. What is it? Oh, it's a thermostat. Okay, I won't take that on in any sort of a way. So holding on to your account credentials, because unlike the account credentials on sort of like your Amazon account, where the worst that someone can do is buy a bunch of stuff for you, here someone can gain control of your domain names and damage your business. Because for a lot of users, their internet domain names are a big piece of asset. If you don't think that they're an asset, spend some time looking at the aftermarket about how some of these names are selling, and you'll quickly be realizing that they are this thing that you buy for just a few bucks is a pretty big asset in your business. Other things, so use correspondence to trigger internal checks. So registrars are frequently known for sending you emails, sending you renewal notices, and some people treat those things like spam, and they sort of vector them into some sort of a bit bucket. One of the things that we've observed is that the registrar is sending you, the registrant, that mail because they think that you are in control of that domain name. And so the fact that they're recognizing you is that is actually a good thing. And so what that can do is lead you, the registrant, to make sure that the right people are getting notified. Maybe the email is coming only to one person, and perhaps it should be coming to a role account, like a distribution, or maybe it's going to a person in the wrong department. A lot of folks where the person that registered the name is not really the person who should be managing the name long term. Maintain ownership proof. One of our members, Dave Piscatello, lives in the Lowcountry of South Carolina near the coast, and he maintains what he describes as a hurricane box, and which was a great analogy that we thought that, this is a box of stuff, of papers and things like that, that when the call comes to evacuate, you can grab with two hands and throw into your trunk of your car, and away you go. And so you have all of these papers about maintaining ownership proof and things like that in a well-known spot so they don't wander about your organization. Diversify points of contact and change controls. These are really things that registrants should be doing to not have all of their eggs in one basket, and to know that control of the domain names is spread throughout the organization that they have. and also such that when renewals and things like that happen, and if someone leaves the company, that you update the contact information on the domain. So these are things that big companies have a fair bit of process around, and we're kind of encouraging smaller companies and individuals to take up some of these processes. So what can you do? We've talked about how to be preventative, but then also the part of this is being able to monitor and detect when things are going on. Obviously, if your website is working, there's something that you can tell is working, if you're getting email. But there are other things you can be looking at, monitoring your Whois and DNS information, because sometimes unauthorized changes to your account are reflected in the Whois, and they might represent a precursor, a leading indicator of someone trying to acquire control of your domain name. So, for example, if I wanted to steal a domain name from Warren, one of the things I might do is first hijack his email account, and then have the email come to me, and then you know, trigger some changes in the DNS to open the domain up for it to be transferred, and then transfer the domain out of his registrant account, and I might keep the DNS working and pointing to his site until certain timers and things like expired, and then when I'm basically all the way gone and down the road and away, then I turn off his website and fully control the domain name. And by that time, I've been sort of committing all sorts of nefarious acts along the way, but because it wasn't being observed, he didn't notice, right? And so sort of some of this is to be looking at Whois and DNS to be able to pick up the telemetry that these sort of bad actors will push off. Other things, you can look at the last change timestamp in the Whois information. When was the contact information last updated? This is sort of like, I'm sure that most folks in a room like this do online banking, right? So when I log into my bank, I punch in my password and whatnot, and it says, you last logged in on this date at this time. And I look at that, and I sort of say, yeah, that sounds familiar. You know, they sort of put it right there in front of you. So here's a notion of understanding when was the last time you changed these things. And in a larger organization, matching that up against your change control records and your configuration management system. Another thing that we identified was that we encourage registrants to really understand status codes and to become educated in what those mean, about what does it mean for your domain to be update prohibited, transfer prohibited, and things like that, and understanding the difference between those in a registry. Sure. So now that you, as a registrant, know about all these things, we very much encourage you to, as you're looking at making decisions about what registrar to use for your current names, your new names, or wherever names, is to do some research on them. You know, talk to them, ask about what their account manager looks like, understand what sort of security measures they offer, look at what their correspondence tempo is, and how you can use that to help trigger some of these internal checks. Have they defined a correspondence tempo where they can enumerate to you what those emails are that they're going to send to you about renewal notices and expiry notices? Do they have a calendar and a timeline that they can publish to you? Understand what their security measures are on their account managers. What sort of session timeouts do they have on them? How many logins do they allow? What sort of information do they give back to you after you've made changes? Do they send you an email after you've made a change to your account? Probably you've also at your online bank gotten a notice if you update your email address. They will send you a notice to the old email address saying, by the way, Rick. Of course, your email probably wouldn't say, by the way, Rick. It would have your name. But they would say, by the way, you just changed your email. If this is a surprise to you, you know, give us a call because someone just changed it. So lastly, you know, sort of look at the registrar's reputation in the industry. There are a large number of registrars out there. I don't know the name, but I think there's over 900 accreditations that have been issued. Staggering number. And quality varies widely, as a lot of folks in this room understand. And so that's sort of an overview of SAC 044. What kind of questions? This is a very quick overview because 30 pages would bore the tears out of anyone. So, any questions? Yes, Rod.
Hi, thanks, Rick. Rod Rasmussen. And you knew I'd have questions on this one. And this is a great report, by the way. Terrific work. I thought what would be interesting, I don't believe that this was part of the report, but would be actually some data on hijackings. If you'd consulted any or had any that some of this was based on, and then kind of empirical data going forward would be nice to track as these incidents happen. There's lots of anecdotal stories out there. If people notice a defacement or something like that after a hijacking, it'll get in the news. But there's no central repository, as you would, of that kind of information. So that's kind of a comment. I guess a question and a comment. The particular question, I had a question. I'll see if I can remember what it was here real quick. But if you want to respond to the first bit.
So we'll let Rod's disk spin up. We did not have any empirical data, right, that we looked at or about the account hijackings or something. SAC 040 listed, three or four pretty high-profile ones, the kind that made the news. Like a lot of these security things, you know, we believe that a lot of these hijackings don't go completely reported unless they're sort of imminently visible in the public eye. Because the other thing is that with a fair number of these hijackings, the possession of the domain name can be reverted, right? Because as someone comes forward with, oh, well, so-and-so stole my name, right? And they go and they'll go through a process with the registrar, some of which might only take, you know, not like a month, but like 2 hours, and they'll get their name back, right? But the thing that you don't hear about is what the business disruption or the operational disruption is during that time. Quite obviously, as you well know, people are not really wanting to sort of stand up and wave their hand and say, hey, my company screwed up and our website was down for X hours. You know, a lot of times some things like this, may actually be a problem with the registration account, but they could get blamed on, oh, we had a network problem, right? Sort of the quintessential fallback of a software guy is, of course, to blame the network, right? And so that's one thing that, you know, a lot of times you see these where, oh, so-and-so had a network problem. Well, yeah, they did have a network problem. They had a network run. The DNS was down, so the network didn't work. The DNS was down because their account got hijacked and the domain name got taken away from them. So, yeah, you know, of course it was a network problem. So, how's your cache doing? Refreshed? Go back a couple of pages. So we'll see. This may be a first. Rod doesn't have a question in the presentation. Any other questions?
Are there any questions from people on the telephone?
We good? Okay, there we go. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Moving on to invalid TLD queries at the root level of the DNS. Dave Piscatello presenting remotely.
Good morning. Are you able to hear me?
We are.
Great. I'm going to talk today about a report that ESSAC published shortly prior to the Cartagena meeting. And the report has to do with strings that appear at the root that are resolved in particular ways today that may change as we introduce new TLDs. So I believe that you're on the slide that says root system resolves TLD strings as follows. I'd like to talk about the four scenarios that exist when a name is resolved by the DNS today. So if a name or a string exists in the root zone, particularly a TLD string, a positive result is returned. So .com, .org, .net, the ccTLDs return positive results today. If a string is not delegated and has never been queried, that is a scenario that is self-explanatory. There is no query. There's no response. A third case is where a string is not delegated but has been queried. This happens with some regularity, either because of a configuration error in an end device or because of a processing or sequencing error in the way that search through namespaces is implemented by various operating systems and network operating systems. And in those cases, a string that is not delegated today would return in the next domain. The fourth case is one where a string was previously delegated but has been removed. This would be the case where a TLD was instantiated or an applicant had been approved, and then the TLD ceases operation. In that case, a string that had previously been delegated and previously returned a positive result would return an NX domain. The conditions that we're going to talk about today are conditions 2 and 3, and we think that these are of interest to the new TLD applicants. Next slide, please. One of the things that we want to emphasize is that non-delegated TLD strings appear routinely today at the root. And as I've mentioned, they're a result of configuration errors or incorrect processing of queries from namespaces other than the DNS. While we at ICANN meetings tend to think very clearly in terms of the domain name system and think of it as a singular namespace that everyone uses, there are certainly other namespaces that are used for LAN operating system protocols and other ways for computers to exchange information on local area networks. And those namespaces, the way that they're implemented in various operating systems and devices and the way that namespaces are searched is not always exactly the way that people anticipate, and some configuration mismatches between one vendor's implementation and another vendor's implementation will result in a query appearing to be a query that has to be sent out to the DNS where it should actually remain local. So some of the traffic that you see in the graph that was provided in a 2009 OARC workshop in Beijing illustrates some of the names that represent a fairly significant, although manageable, load at root servers. And the strings there, obviously, are strings that are familiar to a lot of people. LAN, actually, this is very small for me to read, and I'm getting old. Localhost. These are all strings that, in fact, ought to have remained within the local domain of an end or edge network. If you look at the sum of those, some of that traffic, it represents 10% of the total query load at root and name servers. So this is a measurable and substantial number. Next slide, please. So let's look at some of the implications for new TLD applicants. Since we're using the day in the life of the internet data as representative of the kinds of traffic that occurs normally, one of the things that SAC observes is that certain strings appear with measurable and meaningful frequency. So what if a TLD operator or an applicant would choose to use such a string? Well, one of the consequences is that the operator would inherit this traffic. Another consequence is that inheritance is probably persistent because the conditions that are causing those invalid queries today have been around for at least as long as we've been observing these invalid queries on the root, which is somewhere between 3 to 5 years from what I've gathered in in looking back at some of the data that OARC and others have examined. So if you're inheriting this volume of traffic on the day that you begin operations with this string, it's likely that you will continue to receive that traffic. Next slide, please. What are the implications for users? One of the big implications, and the one that is perhaps of some concern for a number of different reasons, is that the behavior of the DNS for some end users and for private networks is going to change. So let's look at a string X, and let's say X, or it has to be two letters, XX, I should choose something else, YY, is applied for and becomes a string in the root. And let's say that string actually had never been queried before. We don't have a problem. If the string had been queried before with some regularity by a private network or by end users, then the situation changes for that, that group of users, where before he would receive, a user would receive a non-existent domain, now the domain resolves. And in particular, the top level of the domain resolves, and now whatever second level or label happens to be attached to that query is going to be queried through the recursive resolution process with some unpredictable results, because the same situation will now exist on every sublabel. If there is no there's no second level label in that TLD, then you would again get a non-existent domain. But if there is one, then you might actually be directed to a site that you'd never visited before and did not intend to visit. Next slide. So the major finding in this report, I've captured it on the slide, is that any new TLD registry operator may experience unanticipated queries, and some TLDs may experience a non-trivial load of unanticipated queries if the label it chooses corresponds to TLD strings that have historically seen queries. Next slide, please. So SAC's recommendations are to begin with, promote a general awareness of the potential problem. As part of that awareness, we recommend that ICANN and the community study invalid query data at the root level of the DNS. We are also cognizant of several different hardware and software vendor implementations that actually illustrate the problems of having a non-uniform interpretation of the sequence in which namespaces are queried. And we also are aware of certain programming errors that cause invalid TLD queries. And finally, configuration between end systems and access devices such as firewalls and routers that cause these invalid TLD queries. And we believe that it's worth the entire community's while to go and try to remedy all these. Next slide. A second recommendation is to consider the prevalence of certain strings that that are seen and have been seen consistently at the root, and consider whether or not it's appropriate to prohibit the delegation as the IETF through RFC 2606 has for certain other strings, such as example. This would require ICANN to coordinate with the internet community, and in particular the IAB and IETF, to not only consider the criteria of volume of traffic, but other criteria, and to define specific criteria for expanding the current list of prohibited strings and provide a successor to RFC 2606. Next slide. Okay, that's the sum of the presentation. Are there any questions?
I would like to ask a question. One of the motivations for this piece of work, and this is a question that I'm asking the audience here, Dave, not so much you, because you and I have discussed this before. One of the motivations for this work was the observation that there are queries, invalid queries, going to the root on a continuing basis, and that under the GTLD program, somebody might apply for a name that has this traffic that is built in, as it were. And so that raises the question of is there a security vulnerability, because queries are going to a name which will now resolve, and in the extreme, the inheritor or the group that gets that name delegated can now choose to give back any kind of response that they want to those queries. Most likely, the result might not be as bad as that suggests, because there are plenty of opportunities up and down the stream for ISPs and others to intercept invalid names and substitute responses and so forth. So just because somebody's now getting a name that used to not resolve at the root and now will isn't necessarily as qualitative a vulnerability as it might first appear. But we don't have much data on this, and so there's a question of what opinions people might have. So I'm sort of curious what the temperature level is, what the sense of whether anybody wants to raise that question. Harold, you were raising your hand.
So I was asking for a clarification of this recommendation, because there are two reasons to prohibit this thing. One is to prohibit the registration, because the guy who does the registration could get a nasty surprise. The other one is that you should prohibit the registration because the guy doing the registration might be able to do evil things to those who do the lookups. So are we protecting is the intent of the recommendation to protect the registrant or protect the user? Or both?
Yeah, it falls to a certain extent across the both answer. With respect to protecting the registrant, it's at very least an eyes wide open kind of recommendation that they should become aware that this traffic exists, and that as they, if they're going to go into that. But it's a more strongly even focused on not so much evil, but just even surprise. And so we're raising a flag here to bias things in favor of either negative or go slow or be very careful, given that the name is already in use, in effect. Sorry.
Hang on.
Two people.
I'd like to. This is Roy Ahrens. Instead of prohibiting the delegation, I would just restrict it to prohibiting the registration of the domain. It might be an opportunity later on to delegate certain domains away to basically away to somewhere else, like we do for the refer space in editor.arpa, to reduce the load on the root servers. If that language is in there, prohibiting the delegation, then we will not be able to do that later on. Thank you.
Let me offer a comment there, Roy. I think that's an insightful comment. That said, although Dave opened up with that there's a measurable and perhaps even substantial by some means load on the root servers today coming from these names, it's a very small fraction, or a relatively small fraction, of the total load on the root servers. And so it's not in the range where it raises the question of whether it's overwhelming the root servers, per se. I suppose if it ever got up to that, then that would raise new questions. But that, in my mind anyway, and there's some variation of opinions, that was not the primary driver. The primary driver is on the qualitative changes that come about from registering and then delegating that name and opening up a change in the flow.
Yeah. Rod Rasmussen again. It strikes me that one of the things I might do if I saw this data and I happen to run a monetization kind of program is when I think, wow, here's a whole bunch of free traffic I can go get. I know from the DNS you're not going to be able to tell what port they're actually trying to make a query for, and you don't necessarily know the second level label that they're looking for. But this, that the latter part there is something that could actually be determined in theory by resolving those in sampling. I would have a concern that there might be a land rush towards these kinds of things here, but would might be misplaced because a lot of these things would not be coming across port 80. That's just a kind of an observation slash comment, but it might be a something to take in consideration given the landscape of what's going on with the new TDLDs.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let me make a subtle distinction. As you point out, you wouldn't know what port they are intending to reach, but the query to the root will be for a fully qualified domain name, so you'll see the second and third or whatever part of that, which, and so if it says foo.something, then you would see that it's likely that, or if it said mail something, so there would be some clue that is available just from looking at the query information.
So, comment, this is Danny McPherson. I was going to observe, I think 2606 actually asked for an IANA registry to be established for suffixes that should be reserved or that label space, and there's not actually a registry that records those things today. This discussion came up with there's a DNS multicast extensions document that calls for the reservation of .local for MDNS, and it sort of falls within the space as well. As a matter of fact, some people see those queries that sort of aren't link local as that was intended to be. And so the establishment of that registry would certainly be useful as 2606 initially intended. But there is a concern there in particular with the notion of GTLDs and even Rod's comment on domain name front running, which is that if that registry exists, and it could be seen as an in-round option for reserving a GTLD, for example. So just an observation. Or prohibiting a GTLD, either way.
This is Bill Manning. Some of this actually looks very familiar from when the IANA allocated RFC 1918 public address space. And those queries for that address space ended up going to the roots, and there was quite a bit of it. And there was a discussion as to whether or not to prohibit the delegation or to create specific delegation points to capture that data and prevent it from leaking. So the committee might want to talk with the ICANN DNS folks about how they manage and why they manage the systems called blackhole.iana.org. Because that operationally captures a lot of the stuff and keeps it from going to the roots.
Looking around to see if Elise is here. We can try to close that loop. You can do it too. That's a good idea. It was Frederico? Nope. So I don't see any other questions in the room. Any on the phone or in the chat room? Nothing on the chat room, nothing on the phone. Very nice, Dave. Thank you very much. So we'll move on to Registry Transition Program, Jim Galvin.
Thank you, Steve. Let me first start by just saying thank you to Dave Piscatello, the ICANN staff who supported this work. As usual, the ICANN staff has been doing a great job, and Dave certainly did with this too. There are other people who are part of the work party. I represent the chair of the ESSAC work party, and not in the room, we have Patrick Bolstrom and Jeff Bedzer, and then here in the room, we've got Rick Wilhelm and Steve Crocker, and Ram Mohan's actually not in the room either, but he was earlier. So, okay, next slide, please. This work was motivated by the fact that the DAG has some additional requirements in it now about wanting to look at the registry failover issues. And considering, and the motivation here from the point of view of the work is about protecting registrants and ensuring that they're going to be properly served by registries going forward. There's a separate document that is the set of procedures that go along with the reference to wanting to pay attention to the requirements, some SLAs that are specified for registries. And so ESSAC was asked to take a look at that and So what we've done is go through that document, and this is just an update of a work in progress. It's an indication of some of the questions that we're looking at and we're discussing, and so we're very interested in your thoughts, any comments that you have about that work, either here now or certainly feel free to come up and talk to us at any time afterwards if you have some comments or suggestions you want to offer. So next slide. The document does speak to, it identifies five specific critical registry service questions. And so these are the issues that transition processes need to consider, the set of procedures, DNS resolution and properly signed zones when DNSSEC is present. You've got the shared registry system, so that's the server side of the EPP protocol, the interactions with registrars, which is what would be true in ICANN contracted registries. The registration data itself, of course, and its access, because it's all accessible via WHOIS. And then the data escrow requirements, which are part of this too. Obviously, if you're going to do a transition, you need to be able to have access to data so that you can roll it over into a new service provider. So the questions that we're studying, one of the first questions that came up is, what does it mean to protect the registrant? I mean, there's a lot of critical registry functions. A lot of that is support. And I think it's important to understand what actually a registrant gets out of that in order to be able to prioritize those functions and then begin to look at the procedures that are important, what you need to invoke quickly, and what you can do in a more methodical or a structured fashion in order to restore a registry service. And also, what is the risk being addressed? I mean, as you're trying to figure out what it means to protect a registrant, what does the registrant expect, or what should they expect if they actually understood the system, as we are often faced with the question of how much does a user really know? I mean, from the point of view of a user, things actually work, and so they look to the experts to examine the details and sort of consider what's important in what the registrant is trying to accomplish, what they need in order to continue doing what they're doing and achieve something. And so we've been examining the order of priorities. The document and the procedures does actually speak to the fact that resolution services are critical. We've been thinking about some other subtleties that go with that. I think it's fair to say that the resolution services are number one because that's what most affects the user community at large, business community. That's what people see. I mean, the registry may go away itself, which means that you can't create and add names, but your ability to be able to have access to websites, to be able to see the internet, to do lookups, or if you're someone who has a domain name and you have a website or other internet-based service, you want to be able to advertise that, and so you need those DNS services. So DNS services, DNSSEC operations are obviously critical too. If you're going to give a priority to DNS services, the document doesn't speak it mentions them, but it doesn't speak very directly to this issue of DNS services. There are obviously timers, and there are issues that have to be dealt with there. Signatures expire, keys will expire and need to roll over. So there are other issues to be considered. Name server changes may also be critical in this issue because if I want to change my DNS services, I need to be able to make that change, and there may be a variety of reasons that I don't have control over as a domain holder in wanting to move my DNS services. And if my registry isn't available or my registrar is not available to let me make those changes, then that becomes a critical issue. We do make the observation explicitly that changes to existing registration data or adding and removing domains are probably less critical issues. The most important thing from a user point of view is you have to maintain services that people see now. That's really the distinction and the line that we're trying to draw there. I mean, everything is important, but the number one priority is to make sure that what works today and the user experience that people expect needs to continue going forward. Next slide. Another question is, what exactly triggers a downtime? Currently, all of the existing triggers really are technically based. They do make reference to wanting to examine applications for business reasons to see if certainly you're going to be suitable to support a registry business. But what if, from a technical point of view, everything is working and yet the business itself is having issues? And so that becomes a problem. And all of the focus in the SLAs that are currently in the procedures all talk about downtime. And the other question that we have here is about those the thresholds of those downtimes. What exactly are the thresholds for an emergency? If we're going to prioritize the set of services that need to be moved, then you need to think about how quickly it is that you have to identify the problem and then the circumstances that cause it. This just goes back to the general issue of being able to monitor how you're going to monitor, what it means to monitor, and how you're going to interpret that monitoring data and who's going to have that responsibility. Another interesting question that the document does not address at all, but it's important to bring up in this context. You could say that the document, the external procedures, are about what to do if a transition is going to take place. But nothing actually speaks to the question of what motivates the transition. I mean, is it possible that there are registries that you don't want to save? The canonical example here is, you know, certain community or corporate-based registries. I mean, there may be nothing wrong with the corporation itself, but, you know, maybe their registry isn't working and they just, I mean, it just fell apart and they're done and they want to move on. So one of the things that this document doesn't talk about is the decision process. There's more than just SLAs. This goes back to the question of the SLAs are all technically based, but there may be business reasons why it's failing, and for those same business reasons, it might be appropriate to fail. It may not be that it's not a registry that you want to save. That issue is not addressed at all. There's also the question of what if the decision is wrong? How do you stop it? You know, how do you appeal the decision to move on? These topics, these questions are not addressed at all in the document that's out there. And, of course, what is the process for acting on an emergency when the delay is intolerable? So this goes back to the issue of if you accept that DNS resolution is the critical service, and the most critical service of all of the things in a transition that have to occur, okay, how do you make that happen right now? I mean, you've already had a delay because you had an SLA that had to not be met. Then you're going to have an additional delay because a decision has to be made and there has to be a process that deals with that. Now what do you do in order to make sure that that actually occurs now? And that particular issue in the large is not addressed in this document. Other things, questions relating to the overall process is the document as it's written now seems to suggest that the existing operator is excluded once it's transitioned away. It could be that the existing operator was just having a temporary problem. Maybe they weren't having a significant issue, and they were able to correct the issue, and now that they've corrected it, they'd like to take services back and be able to continue and move forward. But the document does not allow that opportunity. It doesn't speak to the issue at all. It does not speak directly to the question of moving services separately. It seems to focus on moving a registry as a whole. Although it identifies individual services, it doesn't talk about moving them individually. And another interesting thing is, could they be moved separately to independent providers? There's a large focus on everything has to move to one place. So it does make the decision process for moving a little more interesting. You now have to choose one place to take everything to. And if you have critical resources or critical services that have to be restored like DNS, it might be interesting to consider moving them right away in some mechanism while you consider what to do about the rest of the services that have to be transitioned. And then we just pose the question of distinguishing levels of harm as a way of driving some of these priorities. Questions related to the emergency operators. So the program that's documented does identify what's called an emergency operator, and people can submit applications, organizations can submit applications to be considered an emergency operator. They would be paid a stipend in order to be on hot standby, if you will, and prepared to take on a registry if they needed to and bring all these services back on board. But one of the things that's interesting is if you do this, the rules actually state that they're not allowed to take any billable transactions at the time. If they are the registry operator and they have brought the services back on, they're not allowed to do any billable transactions. Well, one of the issues there is in terms of responding to abuse, you may actually have to make allowances for that. And that exception is not called out. That's an exception that we point out. There may be reasons why you in particular want to remove domains, you know, take them out of the registry, take them out of the zone, and that rule suggests that that's not permitted and not allowed. There's also no suggestion for regularly auditing the successor and emergency registry operator. The successor operator is, you know, eventually as you move to the registry, the emergency, you then go through a process of selecting who's going to be the successor. DNSSEC is something which is not completely addressed, and so one of the things that we've been thinking about is the things related to DNSSEC when you're going to affect a transition. So a question that comes up is there must be a lower bound. It feels like there needs to be a lower bound on signatures that registries use and apply to their zones in order to ensure that there's adequate time for a transition to take place. You don't want significant events like key rollovers and signature expirations to be taking place while you've got to make a transition. This, of course, also relates to the need to prioritize those services. And sometimes, as identified earlier, I mean, a delay in moving certain services might be intolerable. And this affects all of that. So there's sort of a larger picture here that needs to be looked at. And then data escrow. Data escrow is, you know, it just the problem here, of course, is you do have escrow data. One of the SLA requirements is that you're not allowed to miss your escrow deposits. But it doesn't speak to the issue of the quality of the escrow data, which, of course, now comes to bear here. If I'm going to transition a registry, then I have to be able to take that escrow data, and I have to assume that it's good quality data. Well, you know, I mean, maybe it's not. If we assume that things are all done in good faith, then it's probably fine. You take the latest one. But if there's any possibility that there might be anything, you know, suboptimal in this process of a registry failing, maybe the latest escrow deposit is not the right one. I might need to go back and pick an older one. How do I make those decisions? How do I accomplish that? None of this is addressed, and there's no indication of wanting to have the option of looking back to prior registry escrow deposits and doing that. There's also the question of whether all the critical information is in the escrow. And we, in particular, we're thinking about the DNSSEC information. In many ways, your DNS operator is probably doing most of your DNSSEC operations. And so that information is probably located there. But we need to take a closer look at some of the questions that the information that's there and some of that data. Issues requiring further study, we, you know, sort of compile a list as we're working as things turn up, and you think about recommendations as you're going through this process of looking at some of these issues. So these are just some of the things that are currently on the table that we're considering. The testing process, of course, it would be good to test the registry transition process, and that's not actually proposed or documented anywhere. And we make the observation that you could actually do a full-on complete execution of a transition process and just not move the name server records. And that way you'd actually get a very good look at how all of this works. I mean, as with all of these kinds of things, you know, when failures occur, you don't want to be in a place where you're trying to test your process at the same time that you actually need it to work. And it's very good that you can actually do that with this. Obviously, DNS resolution services need to be the number one priority. I mean, I've been saying that sort of all the way through, but that's clearly going to be a critical recommendation, and try to call that out as a distinction in the recommendations. And then, of course, one of the other things we've observed in this process is that the registrant, we need to make sure the registrant is able to keep their name. In addition to the DNSSEC issues with signature lifetimes and key rollovers and such that come to bear, well, what about domain names that would have expired or need to renew or were in their grace period, and all of that's happening at the time the transition is taking place? One of the things that we're suggesting here is it might be a good thing to suggest that all names in the registry suddenly have to go on lockdown in order to ensure that they don't disappear unexpectedly, at least until a transition occurs, and then you figure out what you're going to do and give people time to recover from all of that. And I think that's it, isn't it? Is there more? Next steps. Okay, well, sure. Well, we're just going to continue to do our work. We're obviously working with Patrick Jones, who's raising his hand. I'm sure he's going to have some questions and comments to make. He's the ICANN staff who's representing this work on the ICANN side. And obviously our goal is to try and you know, publish a report approved by ISAC and get that all done in time for the March meeting. that, I do believe, is the last slide, right? Yeah. Okay. So any questions, and I'll look to Patrick right away.
Well, so I have a couple of questions, but first off, Francisco Arias from the services staff is the current holder of the language from the applicant guidebook. But I wonder if whoever's managing the slides can go back one to have a couple points. So you have an issue requiring further study, and some of this, I mean, there have been examples of registry transitions managed by, you know, VeriSign's done some, you guys have done some, and I would think that that's real-world examples of how you've moved services from, I mean, obviously that's at a back end, but there have been examples, and if there's some lessons learned from that that might be useful as SAC is looking at this, to the extent that those operators are able to share information or provide some, that could be useful. But the other point I just wanted to clarify, when you were referring to as the document in question, did you mean a document that the work party is developing, or do you mean specifically the section in the draft applicant guidebook related to registry transition? Just so I'm clear.
I guess it would depend on context, but I think most of the time when I said the document, I was referring to the section in the draft applicant guidebook.
Yeah.
So you wanted to offer a comment to what he said? Rick was actually in the queue, but if you want to respond to what...
So a real quick one on the... one of the things you said about emergency operators have to be... need to be audited, and you made a point. I think there's also a statement in the current document that says that we had talked about that says that oddly, the emergency operator is not eligible to be the permanent operator. And so one of the things that we had talked about was that that actually implies that there's going to have to be two transitions, which could be, you know, twice as fun for the registrant community in that TLD. So that was something we talked about might warrant some further study.
Yeah, thank you for that. You actually brought up two separate things. One is the rule in the current rules that say that the emergency operator cannot be the successor operator. And that may have some consequences with respect to who's willing to be an emergency operator and who's willing to be a successor operator. And you may not get the right things to happen when you have a rule like that. So that was one. And then the second thing that you said is the observation that there are two transitions that are going to occur in presumably relatively rapid succession. The emergency operator is just to get things back right now, and then you're going to evaluate what you're really doing going forward. And that's not really called out anywhere in all of this. So, yeah, thanks for that. Steve?
Yeah, so with respect to the last point about the two transitions, and I think there's a legitimate question about whether that's over constraining the process. But in any case, even if there are two, one of them would be fairly quick and the other one would be more considered and have probably a different time frame. I wanted to respond to Patrick to your reference to looking at previously worked examples of transitions. I think the in my mind the quintessential worked example, so to speak, was the abrupt lights out at KPM Quest several years ago. And so if one wants to use that as a baseline for how was it done, that serves as a strong negative example in the sense that one would hold that up as, oh, that's the way we want to see this happen.
Yeah, you've provided that, I know, to me in the past, and I have that record, so that it could make it available directly.
I don't think I've provided anything that wasn't publicly available, and I don't know that I've got it easily and actively available. If you're concerned about a matter of form, let me ask you, send it back to me, and I will resend it to you, and I will take off any implied caveats, and then it will be wildly on the record. Yeah.
Roy, I'm Rod, and then Francisco.
Rod Rasmussen. I'm just noticing point two here on this slide talks about escrowing DNS zone files and having just co-chaired the zone file access group for the new GTLDs program. One of the things that we ran into, one of the proposed models was actually a central repository, but that was we ended up going a different direction out of the concerns around cost and who would be able to have that. If you actually create a repository for zone files so that we can have a transition, it kind of solves that problem. So it's, I don't really want to re-grow over that ground, but this particular issue may, you know, lead to a better optimization for that zone file access solution in the future.
This is Ram. Rod, I don't think it would, because the zone file repository is doesn't capture the temporal changes nearly as well as an escrow would, because the requirements on an escrow tend to be at a higher level of both reliability as well as the frequency of data that has to get stored is much higher. With validation and the and a contractual requirement, if you will, to make sure that the data is deposited right, is accessible, and accessible by a third party at any given time. So I think it's materially different. And while the a centralized zone file is a good idea that provides some efficiency, I'm not certain that we could depend upon that when there is failure.
I'll say a little more about the motivation for that requirement is, in fact, for a lot of registries, right, the zone file data is actually in the registry database, which we're also already escrowing. So what's interesting in this is bringing the DNS up either means that you have a separate file somewhere with just DNS data in it, so it's a lot less data to deal with, or you also still have to parse and bring up the registry database in order to get at the zone file in order to bring up DNS. So that's really just a process question. That's what sort of motivates this. Did you want to be in the queue or respond to this? Okay. So, Francisco?
Thank you, Jim. I just wanted to say that I'm seeing a lot of good questions to the process. I have some answers, but I'm not sure there's enough time to go through all this. If I may, I would like to suggest if we could work together, maybe I could certainly answer those questions privately, I mean, in this time.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. And Harold, you have a mic.
So just a completely orthogonal remark. This morning I was listening to someone worrying about the ability to shut down his TLD without anyone taking over. In particular, this was someone who imagined having a brown TLD and then deciding that this was a stupid idea and it should go away, but he would still wanted to control the brand. Just a word of warning. We shouldn't imply in the report that all TLDs will live forever. Sometimes sometimes they go away, and that's the right thing.
I was taken with the point made by KPN Quest, and the thing that I think's the most difficult in this particular question is actually not technical but legal, and that is where you're facing bankruptcy. So I know how I think Ram just made the point about a escrow and contractual requirement for it to be available to third parties. I think that's an area which is incredibly important for investigation further to make certain you've got really thought the legal things through that. KPNS Quest problem was actually an administrator seizing the asset, that issue will continue. So I think the legal aspects about how do you provide service during a period of bankruptcy, I think, is probably worth thinking through.
Thank you. Let me note that we're crunched for time. We have one more item on the agenda that although it's short, the time that we have for it is even shorter. Are we close to done for this?
Yeah, I won't say any more.
Anybody on the chat room or phone that wants to ask a question?
There's a comment from Yap that the KPN Quest was solved by doing a routing trick. There's a comment on the Jabber on the Adobe Connect.
Yeah, there was some clueful intervention by good-willed and capable people,
But I'm not sure that that represents a plan.
Very nice. Thank you very much. Steve Shang, with apologies, we're up against the timeline, so if you could say quickly and take us through where we are.
Sure. I'll be speaking from here since I also need to operate the Adobe Connects. So the IRD working group have two main objectives. The first one is discussing how to internationalize the domain registration data. Previously, all these data are in U.S. ASCII. As the internet is becoming more internationalized, should we have those data remain in U.S. ASCII? And if we have allow more registration data in other scripts, how do we do so to avoid a so-called of a Tower of Babel effect in the domain registration data or the WHOIS? And the second question is how to specify how to internationalize the WHOIS protocol. So here's are the issues discussed so far by the working group. The first one it tackled is the WHOIS protocol able to support internationalized registration data? And I think the input from ASAC is the WHOIS protocol in its current capacity lacks support for mechanism to indicate character encodings. Then the working group discussed what are the capabilities that are needed for directory service in the IDN environment. I use the word directory services because the word WHOIS can be used very confusingly in ICANN debate. So, we also discussed about query and display of IDN variants in WHOIS, and finally models to internationalize the contact data. So the working group has issued an interim report, and it's also published in 6 UN languages, as this is a fairly internationalization effort. There's going to be a public session tomorrow from 9 to 11 a.m., so welcome you to participate.
Thursday.
And the IRD working group will review the comments and address remaining issues and issue a final report. So that's all.
Very well done. Questions? All right. Thank you. It's a couple minutes past our allotted time. Things have become very densely scheduled at this ICANN meeting, as they always are, but even more so than usual, I think, at this one. So with that, let me thank everybody for coming. As usual, this has been well attended and I think a fairly contentful meeting and much appreciated. And see you all in San Francisco. I'm sorry, one more thing. DNSSEC, lengthy session tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock in the main room, Gethsemane. 8:30, excuse me, 8:30. And it includes lunch and